Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Tom Siegfried, science writer and former editor-in-chief of Science News. We're talking about his new book, The Number of the Heavens, A History of the Multiverse and the Quest to Understand the Cosmos. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This is a really fascinating book. It did something that I don't think other books have done. This is really how a history of how people have tried to figure out what is everything.
Like, right.
How big is everything? And right up through the most contemporary ideas today, but what an unusual idea for a book.
Well, it's a natural idea if you start to think about the arguments that are going on today about that very question.
The arguments
about how big the universe is and how big reality is and what's the totality of existence is a big argument today in physics and astronomy, and it just occurred to me that the same argument has gone on for 2,500 or so years, so it seemed to me like it would be a nice story to tell.
You sum it up really well at the very end of the book. You said, it's about the word universe. It's not a word with a clear, unchanging meaning. It may mean everything, but how everything is conceived and described depends upon the knowledge at that given time. And it really is fascinating to follow this story through, because in the beginning, Earth was at the center, and we were sort of in this sort of center of several shells, and then it just keeps progressively, as the tools and the knowledge get better, the universe keeps growing.
Right, that's exactly the exact point. The idea of what the universe is changes over time based on what we know, and people argue about whether there can be more than one universe today based on what we conceive of the universe as today. It's this big expanding bubble of space and time that keeps growing and growing. But throughout history, the idea of what the universe was different, and they had the same argument about
right.
whether there was
it's,
more than one.
It's weird.
They were arguing about a different thing.
Well, they're arguing about different scales of things. I mean, according to their knowledge, they were still arguing about multiverses, but it was just their idea of what the universe was multiplied.
Exactly.
There's several themes in your book that I find really fascinating. One of them is that, yes, science did occur during the medieval period. And we'll talk about that. And the other one is people really had to come out from underneath the Aristotle and the church in order to make any progress whatsoever.
Right.
Talk to me about right. that. I mean, Aristotle really seemed to have, everybody wanted to make, even if they found new information, they still had to dovetail it so that it agreed with Aristotle.
Right. That was actually one of the key motivations for the book also, is the fact that in the year 1277, the Bishop of Paris issued these decrees, one of which was you could no longer teach that there was only one universe or that there could only be one universe, which is what Aristotle had supposedly established way back in ancient Greece. Aristotle figured out logically to him, which was pretty important since he pretty much invented logic, that there could only be one universe, and that was what the medieval scholars who adopted Aristotelian philosophy all believed and all taught in the early years of the Middle Ages. But the Bishop of Paris pointed out that denied God the power to create as many universes as he wanted.
Right.
So, therefore, it was no longer permitted to teach that, and all of a sudden all the scholars in Paris, and since Paris was the leading center of theology, most elsewhere as well, started saying, well, now that we think about it, maybe there could be more than one universe, so as they would avoid being excommunicated. So, but that opened the door. That opened the door to the discussion, which Aristotle had closed off, and so now it was permitted and allowed to discuss the possibility. And some people would say, well, yeah, sure, God could make more, but he probably didn't. But then there were others who seriously explored the idea that there could be more than one universe as we thought it was then, a bunch of spheres carrying planets with the Earth in the middle. Could there be more than one of those? And some people said yes. And that was the medieval argument, which really, a lot of the same arguments that were used on both sides in medieval times are very similar to the arguments that are used today.
Part of those arguments involve, rather, the concept of the void, whether a void could exist, whether God would allow a void to exist, sort of the plenum versus the void. Can you talk about that whole controversy?
Right. Aristotle thought a void could not exist, and so did a lot of people back in ancient Greece.
What was the reasoning?
The original reasoning was a void would be nothing, and nothing being nothing can't exist, therefore a void can't exist, which doesn't strike us today as the soundest reasoning, but back in those days that was considered a strong argument. Again, that was something that the Bishop of Paris said. If that was strictly true, then you would be saying that there was no place to move things, and God could move things if he wanted to. So by implication, there must have been a space that God could have used to move things. So that was another one of the points that the bishop said they couldn't teach. So it was like, if there is no void, which is what Aristotle believed, there could be no universes beyond the one that we see, because that would require a void out there for the universes to be in. Once you no longer could no longer prohibit the idea of a void, that made it easier to imagine there being more universes.
Now, the interesting thing about reading your book is, especially with people with even a basic college science background, what these people are doing is really not science. It's more what we call natural philosophy or something like that. I mean, right. They're just sort of trying to figure this out in their head, but it's very tough to test, other than observation, direct observation. And there was a lot of direct observation in records.
Well, there was a lot of observation that went into natural philosophy. And natural philosophy was the forerunner of what we call modern science, modern physics in particular. So it's hard to draw a distinction between what was just philosophy and what became what we call science. It was the science of the time, and it was limited because it didn't have the knowledge we have about things or the instruments we have to investigate things. But people were able to figure things out scientifically, like the fact that the Earth was round, because they
right.
could observe eclipses of the eclipse of the moon by the sun and see that the Earth's shadow was curved. So there was observation that went in to some of their deductions about the universe. But a lot of it was what we call now philosophizing, just trying to think it through and figure it out.
I think people would be surprised to realize that the ancient Greeks came up with the idea of atoms.
Well, I think some people or be surprised at that. Some people would know that. They would have heard that the ancient Greeks had some people who argued for the existence of atoms. What was surprising to me, actually, was that the ancient Greeks who believed in atoms were also the ones who believed in multiple universes.
That's right. That's right.
And that's something that I think is really not well known. And the point about it that I make in my book was it wasn't that that was just another thing that they thought. The atomists believed in multiple universes as an intrinsic part of their theory of atoms. They believed that if everything was made of atoms, there had to be an infinite number of atoms so you could have enough atoms to arrange things in so many configurations that you could get a cosmos, a universe, a set of planets and stars and sun. But if you needed an infinite number of atoms to make that, there would still be an infinite number of atoms left over to make more of those. It was part of their atomic theory that there were multiple universes, which is echoed today in a lot of theories, like the theory of superstrings being the fundamental pieces of what things are made of. And that theory also suggests that there should be a multiverse of some sort.
Needless to say, Aristotle was an atom denier.
Right. he won the argument back in ancient Greece. He argued against Leucippus and Democritus, who were the prime atomists, and Aristotle won the argument in ancient Greece, and it didn't get reopened again until the Middle Ages.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Tom Siegfried, science writer, former editor-in-chief of Science News. We're talking about his new book. It's really an interesting read, and gives you a perspective on scientific ideas that you probably haven't had yet. The Number of the Heavens, A History of the Multiverse and the Quest to Understand the Cosmos. As I mentioned before, one of your bete noires is that people think that science did not happen during the medieval period, during the so-called Dark Ages. And you have an interesting person that you bring up that I was not familiar with. Let's talk about Gross Ateste.
Oh, Robert Gross Ateste. Yes, he was a great thinker. He was a religious figure, and he's known in the religion world as he was a bishop and wrote prolifically on religious issues, but he also wrote on all sorts of different scientific issues, trying to explain the nature of the rainbow, trying to explain sound and heat, and trying to understand the universe. He was the guy who I write about early in the book who came up with, he attempted to devise a physical explanation for how this Aristotelian cosmos that everybody believed in would have come into being. He believed that light went out in all directions and pushed matter with it into shells, and these shells became right. spheres that planets attached to, and the Earth was the heavy stuff left in the middle, and it was a scientific theory. He didn't have the mathematical tools that we have today to try to describe it mathematically, but it was an attempt at a real scientific explanation for how the universe that they believed it to be then, how that universe came to be. The interesting thing was that I write about is how just a few years ago...
This was fascinating. I thought this was really fascinating, and I'd love to read those original papers that these people wrote. Talk to me about it.
Well, this group of scientists and historians got together and looked at this theory and decided, well, he didn't have enough math. Enough math hadn't been invented back then, and he certainly didn't have a laptop to do the calculations on. So they attempted to apply equations to the various ideas in Grosseteste's theory. And they found that you could... He explained it sufficiently that they could figure out what equations would describe the process he was talking about.
Wow.
And they ran simulations to see if they could mathematically verify that you could produce something like this universe. And they first ran it, and it produced something like it, but it had a different number of spheres with a different number of planets and things, and they thought, well, that's not quite the same universe he's trying to get. But then they realized there were certain features like how strong the pressure of was the light that could be adjusted. And if you adjusted those features just right, you could get his theory to produce the universe he was trying to produce. So that was evidence of what a scientific thinker Grosseteste really was, given the time in which he lived. The other point was that this was very similar to modern story of the universe, where we have a Big Bang producing right. our space-time expanding. And if you vary certain physical properties, you could end up with a universe that was not exactly like ours, that had a different amount of matter in it or a different amount of energy driving it to expand. And that's the basis for believing there might be a multiverse today. There might have been multiple Big Bangs with multiple bubbles. With Grosseteste's theory back in the Middle Ages, you could see how that could have done something very similar.
Now, was his concept of the universe similar to that of what the so-called Ptolemaic?
No. Grosseteste was before. Well, yes, Ptolemaic, yes. I was going to say it was more similar to Aristotle. Ptolemaic universe was more complicated than Aristotle's, because Aristotle thought there were these spheres carrying the planets around the Earth. Ptolemy had to make it all mathematically work out, had to add a bunch of features. The planets were a little off-center from the Earth and things like that. So Grosseteste was dealing with Aristotle's simpler model of the universe, but they're closely related. They're both, and the main point was they both had the Earth in the middle, and
that's right.
The way everybody believed the universe was up until, of course, Copernicus.
Ptolemy had these little sort of backward circular motions of the planets along their circular orbit.
Right, circles upon circles.
Circles. That's exactly right. And they always that because yeah. the circle was divine and the ellipse wasn't.
Right. The circle was what Aristotle said was the perfect form of motion. Circular motion was perfect motion, and that goes back even for that Plato, even before Aristotle. Everybody thought back then they were trying to figure out what was perfection, and the heavens were supposedly so perfect they must have circular motion. And again, there was observational evidence, because if you look at the star at night, the sky at night, the stars seem to rotate around the sky like there's a a big circle. So that made sense to them, but that was, everybody thought you therefore had to explain the universe with just circular motion.
You're right that people have tried to date the beginning of science to the condemnation of 1277. Do you buy that?
Well, most historians don't buy that because it was way more complicated than that. I mean, it was an interesting idea that this edict freed up scientists to do more things. So I think, but it was still a long time before you had what we recognize as modern science with people like Galileo. But I think it definitely, with respect to the question of whether there's more than one universe, it definitely opened that part of scientific right. inquiry up. Probably a little bit of an exaggeration to say that it created all of modern science at that point, or everything in modern science began at that point. It was an important point, but maybe an exaggeration to give it all the credit.
There's a point in your book where you deal with the term that people very often misuse, and that's Occam's razor.
Oh, yes.
And I found that section really wonderful. Can you talk about that?
Well, Occam's razor is just often, you know, to say oversimplified would be the way to say it, because people hear it expressed as the simplest explanation is the best explanation.
Oh, my God. People throw it around all the time.
And you see it on TV shows.
Oh, I just did.
It even came up in Westworld. I mean, it was like, but that's not quite the right way to express Occam's razor. It's more like if you use more principles or more elements or more things to explain things than you need, then your explanation is too complicated. But you have to have whatever you need to have to explain what you need to explain. So a simpler explanation is not a better explanation if it doesn't actually explain what you're trying to explain. And so Occam's razor is often used by people. Say the multiverse, if there's an infinite number or a huge number of universes out there, that's way too many things to explain what we see, so that must be wrong. And I like to bring that up, and people, if they argue about the multiverse and they cite Occam's razor, they've already lost the argument, because A, they're misquoting Occam's razor. B, even if they quoted it correctly, it's just a guideline. It's not a law of how to do science. It's just a general idea that sometimes is useful. And C, William of Occam, who is the razor is named for, the guy who promoted this back in the 14th century, he was the biggest advocate for the multiverse among all the medieval philosophers. So it's really not a good idea to use his razor as an argument against the multiverse.
Now, I want to zip ahead for a bit, because I do want to pay attention to the – you really do a great job summarizing all the notions of the multiverse of the last, say, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that's really important is many of the researchers, the theorists, the physicists that you quote in this book are people that you've actually talked to personally.
Oh, yes. That's the interesting part about doing this book the way I did it. The first half, or maybe first two-thirds or whatever, is all, you know, historical research and right. what went on in centuries past. But for the modern era, covering, you know, since the 1980s, is the time I was covering this for a newspaper and then later on for Science News. And so I was at the meetings where these things were being discussed, and I interviewed most of these major figures who were part of the debate. And so I drew on all of that in writing the last few chapters of the book. And that is, you know, a different perspective when you're not just, you know, reading old documents, but you're having conversations with the people themselves and questioning them on points and hearing what they really think and feel about it, as opposed to just their equations.
I want to talk about a couple of ideas and concepts and problems of the last 30 years. And one of them that goes right back to the beginning of the book, the anthropic principle. And, right. and that is still a problem. And talk to me about, and I had never heard this term before, also known as the Nancy Kerrigan problem.
Okay, well, yeah, the Nancy Kerrigan problem.
Now that I've got that in my head, I will never forget that.
Well, Nancy Kerrigan problem is related to what she said after her knee got bashed and right before the Olympics. And she said, "Why me? Why now?" And that question was adopted by astronomers after they discovered that the universe was expanding at a faster and faster rate. Everybody had thought, or virtually everybody had thought, the universe was, they knew it was expanding, but they thought the expansion was probably slowing down over time because the matter, the gravity from all the matter would be slowing the expansion. But when they discovered that it was expanding faster and faster, that implied that there was some energy in space. They call it dark energy, which the unusual property that it pushes space apart and makes it expand faster and faster. Historically, though, if you look back over the whole course of the universe, they could figure out that this was happening only relatively recently, only, you know, a few billion years ago in cosmic terms, as opposed to the universe went several billion years without this going on. And then at some point, not too long before, you know, the Earth was created and people evolved, that this force was making the universe expand faster. So it's a great mystery. Why did it happen right before people appeared? And, you know, why us, why now? And so the explanation for that is not obvious. And people would have thought earlier that you could come up with equations that would say, well, this is just the way it has to be because that's the math that describes the universe makes it that way. But there is no theory that predicts why this amount of dark energy blowing the universe up is exactly the amount it is. So people have examined the question, and some people have pointed out if there were many universes,
that's right,
then it makes sense, because it's like if there was way more of this energy, the universe would have blown up too fast for planets and stars to form, and we wouldn't be here. If there was none of this energy, the universe would have probably only grown to be so big and collapsed back down from gravity before planets and stars could have formed. So it's like we're the lucky ones. The why us, why now question is because if anything had happened differently, the universe would not have the properties we need to be in it. And that's, you know, basically what people call the anthropic principle. It's like we're here because this is the universe that has the, you know, comfy temperature and nice place, nice sunshine and good planets to live on and stuff. And some people think this is crazy. This is ridiculous.
Well, some people start to say this sounds like theology and not physics.
Well, that's exactly what people say, but I think, you know, and when the early days of this argument, they might have had a point, but they really get the argument backwards, because it's really saying that's why you don't need creation event by some deity to make the universe nice for us. If there's a lot of universes and they're all different, one of them is going to be nice for us. And the analogy that some scientists make, which I think is really accurate, is it's just like, why do we live on the Earth instead of living on Jupiter or Pluto or somewhere like that? Well, it's not because planets are required by law to live to orbit a star and right at the right distance for us to live on it. It's that there's a bunch of planets, and we live on the one that's at the right distance where the temperature is nice. So it's like that is an explanation, a natural explanation for why the temperature of the Earth is the temperature it is. If it was vastly different, it would be too cold or too hot for us to live on it. So we're the ones who are asking the question, so we're going to live in a place
that's the right
temperature. So that's the similar argument with the multiverse. We can't explain a lot of features of the universe we see, but if there are a lot of universes with all different features, we would live in the one that's like this one, because in other ones, the features would not be hospitable to life.
One of the great things about your book is you are able to explain concepts like brains, B-R-A-N-E-S, in a much more palatable way. I've interviewed people who actually originated those concepts, and that was a great explanation of that. The problem with a lot of this and the criticisms, and I've also interviewed people who are very critical of the multiverse theory, is that it's untestable, therefore not science. But you bring up some interesting counterpoints to that. Talk to me about that.
Well, the first point about that is, and this is really crucial, people say, yes, the multiverse theory is not testable. The problem with that is multiverse is not a theory to be tested. The multiverse is a prediction of other theories. And those other theories can be tested, at least in principle. And so it's a total, I think the trendy word to say that is category error these days. if you say the multiverse can't be tested, it's a theory that can't be tested, you're miscategorizing it. It's a prediction of other theories. And if you have a theory that predicts a lot of things that are true and predicts something else that you can't actually test, you still have confidence in that theory because it predicts so many things that you can verify. So inflationary cosmology, the idea that right at the Big Bang there was a big burst of expansion called inflation, is the theory. That's the theory of how our universe came to be, and it explains a lot of things we can observe. It has passed a lot of tests. It hasn't passed all the tests yet, so it's not, you know, you cannot say that it's established beyond any doubt. It's right. Still a work in progress, but it has passed many tests, and the fact that it's been successful in so many ways gives you reason to believe that the multiverse that it predicts may very well also be true. It is important to say you can't say for sure yet. You don't know absolutely.
Right.
You don't have the absolute smoking gun, but you have lots of reasons to believe there's reasons to take the multiverse seriously as a prediction of theories that have accomplished a lot of other things. So I think that it is the most common misperception that the multiverse can't be tested. I would add one more point about that. It's very similar to what people said all along about atoms. Before
That's
the 20th century, a lot of people said atoms could not be real either. You cannot see them. There's no way to observe atoms, so therefore they're not scientific. They're just ideas. And, you know, that obviously turned out to be wrong. You didn't need to wait until you invented scanning tunneling microscopes that could actually show you images of atoms to realize you had other evidence that showed you that atoms did in fact exist. So in the multiverse could turn out to be similar to that.
We're completely out of time, and we could talk forever about this book. My guest tonight has been Tom Siegfried, science writer, former editor-in-chief of Science News, and we are talking about his new book. It's really a great read, The Number of the Heavens, A History of the Multiverse and the Quest to Understand the Cosmos. Tom, it's been a real pleasure.
It has for me too, Mark. Thanks.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.